Welcome to Destination Murder, the true crime podcast.
Each week the hosts, that's us, BFS Megan
and Tegan,
cover stories from a new part of the world.
Get ready to combat your travel bug and feed your true crime obsession.
Hello, Tegan. Welcome
hey,
back.
Hey, Megan. It is week two of our month dedicated to murdered and missing Indigenous women. I'm so excited.
It's very odd to be like, I'm so excited to talk about such a terrible topic.
Yes, but I'm excited that we're doing this, and I'm happy that we've gotten some positive feedback on this. So I'm excited to continue this work. Should I say?
Exactly.
I already told Megan this, but this morning when I set my alarm so that we could get up to record our podcast, I still woke up on time because I set an alarm pretty early. But I learned that if you just lay in bed and say, Siri, turn off alarm, it will turn it off and you don't have to roll over and open your eyes. So that's dangerous information that I have now, and I'm probably going to spend my morning after this trying to figure out how I can disable that now that I know that I can do that.
That's not very good information to have.
No. So very... if you didn't know that information before and now you do, I'm sorry.
Love it. Well, like you heard in the intro, this is Destination Murder, a true crime travel podcast. Each week we go to a new place and cover a true crime case from there. And at the end of the episode, we draw a random another place from a hat, our metaphorical hat. But yeah, this month of May, we're doing only in missing and murdered Indigenous women cases, like Tegan mentioned. So this week we are covering North Dakota and Quebec, Canada.
And I think, Megan, you're going first this week, right?
I am first this week, and I'm taking us to North Dakota.
Perfect. I get to sit back and listen to you tell your story while I sip on my coffee.
Yes. So I am taking us to North Dakota today, like I literally just said, and I'm covering the murder of Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. My sources for this week are a Guardian article by Sarah Hilton, Pacific Standard article by Monica Gable, Talk Murder With Me blog, an AP News article by Sharon Cohen, and Wikipedia. So, like Canada, Native American women and girls in America are much more likely to experience gender-based violence than other women. They're 10 times more likely to be murdered than a non-Indigenous woman in the U.S. Similar to Canada, U.S. authorities and police are accused of ignoring the violence against Indigenous women. According to The Guardian, compared to Canada, the U.S. has an immense lack of awareness on the violence perpetrated against Indigenous women. While Canada completed a national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, there's a lack of official information and statistics in relation to this type of crime in the U.S. Despite a severe lack of data on these missing and murdered Indigenous women, in 2016, the FBI's National Crime Information Center estimated there to be almost 6,000 missing and murdered Native American across the U.S. But out of these 6,000 missing, only 116 were in the FBI's missing persons database out of 6,000.
I, like, am speechless. Like, yeah. How is that even possible?
There are some systemic issues, which I will discuss very briefly, quickly. But this basically means that their disappearances are not properly tracked, meaning that law enforcement across the U.S. cannot help in the search for them. So even more so, like I said, systemic issues create a barrier to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls cases earning justice in the U.S. because of the way the U.S. legal system is set up in regard to the state or federal authorities versus reservation or tribal authorities. So many of these cases of violence against Native American women go uninvestigated and unprosecuted. I think you mentioned this in another episode previously, Tegan, but if a crime occurs on a reservation, the reservation authorities can act and investigate. But if an act of violence occurs on a Native American person or woman outside the reservation or by a non-Native American, which, just to remind you, most of the crimes against missing and murdered Indigenous women are committed by white men. So if a crime occurs on the reservation by a non-Native American, the reservation authorities have no jurisdiction and have to request FBI or state police to investigate, and they rarely do. Still today, the U.S. Department of Justice has only pursued prosecution in about half of all murder cases on reservations and has declined over a third of the cases referred to them by the reservation authorities. So that's just a little bit of background for the U.S. because we covered Canada last week. But North Dakota is a U.S. state in the north of the country. It has borders with Montana, Minnesota, and South Dakota. Oh, and the Canadian provinces of Manitoba and Saskatchewan. So Dakota earns its name from the Lakota and Dakota Sioux Native American tribes, whose traditional territory spans across the state, along with that of the Blackfoot, Cheyenne, Chippewa, or Ojibwe, as they are known in Canada, and Mandan nations. Mandan. Apologies if I mispronounced that. The state's population is sitting under 1 million people at only 780,000 people for the entire state.
That is insane. I didn't know. There's 33 million people living in California, but less than a million. Why can't I say a million? Less than a million people in North Dakota.
I know. It almost seems like a wrong statistic. Yeah. I was like, are you sure that's not just the city?
I guess people just don't want to live there. It's like the prairies, like, unless you're, like, doing farming work and, like, agricultural kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of, like, technology and stuff in that region. Wow. That's less people than Vancouver.
I know.
My mind is still trying to, like, process this. Like, what?
I know. So it's one of the most sparsely populated U.S. states because of the extremely low population. The ethnic makeup of Dakota is also very white. About 90% of the population is white American, and then the next largest ethnic group is Native American, sitting at about 5.5% of the population. With this sparsely populated population and one of the largest areas of any U.S. state, agriculture is naturally the largest industry in North Dakota. The geography is fitting, with prairie land sprawling between the foothills of the Rocky Mountains to the west and the Red River Valley to the east. So on one day in August 2017, a pair of kayakers set out on the Red River for a day of kayaking. As they kayaked, they spotted a strange shape caught along a log in front of them. Upon closer inspection, they realized the object was a body wrapped in plastic and duct tape. The remains were that of 22-year-old Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. Savannah was from Fargo, North Dakota, and had been missing for 8 days. Savannah was a member of the Spirit Lake Sioux tribe. By all accounts, Savannah was a kind and generous person. She was the oldest of 4 children and lived at home with her family in an apartment building in Fargo. Her and her family were very close, Savannah even having a tattoo dedicated to her late grandmother, which read, "Too beautiful for Earth." Savannah worked as a nurse's assistant in a senior care home. Savannah also had a boyfriend named Ashton. Like Savannah, Ashton was a member of the Spirit Lake Sioux tribe, and they had been together since they were 15 years old. In early 2017, they found out Savannah was pregnant. Her and her boyfriend were expecting their first child, and everyone in their family was so, so excited. On August 19th, 2017, during her 8th month of pregnancy, Savannah was at home preparing for her baby shower the next day. In her late stages of pregnancy, her feet were swollen and sore, but despite this, she went upstairs to visit her neighbor, named a woman by the name of Britt Cruz, who had asked Savannah for help with something that day and had offered to pay her like $20 as a thank you. Britt Cruz, age 38, lived above Savannah and her family. Brooke lived in the upstairs apartment unit with her boyfriend, William Hone. The two of them were troubled. Both of them had previously had run-ins with the law, and they both had multiple children with other partners, none of which they were in contact with. Brooke was constantly being sued for not paying her child support to her ex-partners. They had been dating since 2014, and in that time, William had assaulted Brooke during their explosive arguments. William had pled guilty to assaulting Brooke in 2017 and was dealt with a no-contact order by the court, but police continued to have to respond to disturbances at Brooke's residence, as William violated his no-contact order and continued to live with her. Savannah and her family did not really know Brooke and William. They had only seen them in passing and had rarely, if ever, spoken to them, but Brooke had asked Savannah to help her with a sewing project. Brooke needed Savannah to model a dress, and being kind, Savannah had agreed despite not being familiar with her neighbor. Before she left, she ordered her family pizza, texted her mom and boyfriend letting them know where she was, and headed up to help out her neighbor at about 1:30 p.m. But unknown to Savannah, Brooke did not need her for a sewing project. Earlier, in January 2017, Brooke and William had had an argument. He threatened to leave her, so Brooke told him that she was pregnant, so he would stay. A while afterwards, William found out that Brooke had actually lied about her pregnancy. He was absolutely furious and said that if she didn't, quote, produce a baby, unquote, he would leave her. Brooke had seen that Savannah was nearly due and planned to take her child.
I think that these types of cases are, like, my least favorite.
Yeah. So, by 4 p.m., Savannah's mother had not heard anything from Savannah, which was really unlike her. Savannah typically replied back quickly to texts, and that, plus the fact that she had not dropped off her brother at work like she was supposed to that afternoon, was very concerning. Savannah's mother went up to see if Savannah was still at Brooke's apartment, but she wasn't there, and Brooke said that Savannah had left around 2:45 p.m. that day. This was extra concerning because Savannah's purse was still at home, and her car was still parked in the parking lot, and Savannah's mom knew that she would not be walking anywhere because her feet were so swollen and sore from pregnancy. At 4:30 p.m., Savannah's mother called the police, who arrived at 5 p.m. They spoke to her mother, then went to search Brooke's apartment. The day of her disappearance, the police searched Brooke and William's apartment twice, and then once again the next day. But these searches might not have been very thorough. When Savannah had gone up to Brooke's apartment on August 19th, Brooke had violently murdered her. As soon as Savannah arrived, Brooke began to pick a fight with her. This led to Brooke pushing Savannah to the ground, and Savannah hit her head on the bathroom sink on the way down and fell unconscious. Brooke then took a knife from the kitchen and performed a rudimentary C-section on Savannah, who was still alive and coming in and out of consciousness throughout. Brooke was able to cut into Savannah's stomach and remove her baby. Savannah died of blood loss. William came home while Brooke was cleaning up the blood. He asked her if Savannah was dead. Brooke said she didn't know, so William strangled her with a piece of rope. He then helped Brooke cover up the murder, cleaning up the crime scene. All of this happened between 2 p.m. and 5 p.m., within a three-hour span. The couple was able to murder Savannah, hide her remains, and clean up the blood from the bathroom, all before the police came to search the apartment at 5 p.m. Like I said, the searches were not very thorough because the police didn't even notice the newborn baby in the apartment with the couple. When the police searched the apartment, Savannah's newborn baby was hidden under the covers next to William as he lay in bed.
What the hell?
Yeah, so they obviously didn't check that hard.
No.
So not only did the police miss the newborn, but they entirely missed Savannah's body, which was hidden in the apartment the entire time. I'm not exactly sure where, but...
Did they hide her body under the covers as well? Like, what?
I don't know.
Oh my god.
So after the police's third search of the apartment, William hollowed out a dresser and placed Savannah's body in it. In the middle of the night, on August 21st, 2 days after Savannah's murder, Brooke and William drove out to a bridge over the Red River and dumped the dresser and Savannah over the side. And then, as they were driving home, they stopped off at Walmart and got involved in a hit and run as well, so... They're fantastic people.
Chaos. I'm just so confused that they would do that to, like, their neighbor, because wouldn't it be extremely suspicious that now you've got a baby?
Yeah, when Brooke was not even pregnant. Meanwhile, police did not really have many suspects other than Brooke and William. Savannah's family felt as though they didn't care about her disappearance. Savannah's mother told the press that it felt like they weren't taking Savannah's disappearance seriously. Alongside the police investigation, Savannah's community rallied around her family. Members of the Spirit Lake Sioux Tribe, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, the Standing Rock Tribe, her friends, her fellow college students, and her neighbors all began searching for Savannah around Fargo. Over 200 of them gathered to search the cities and surrounding forests for Savannah. Police weren't getting much information from Brooke and William, so they asked around for more information. At William's work, his coworkers told police that William and Brooke had a newborn baby at home. This was extremely concerning to the police since Savannah was 8 months pregnant and they had not seen a newborn when they searched the apartment beforehand. This new information allowed them to go get a no-knock search warrant, and on April 24th, they surprised Brooke at home to fully search the apartment. This time around, they found Savannah's newborn baby girl perfectly healthy. The baby girl was confirmed to be Savannah's and taken to live with her father, Ashton. Brooke and William were immediately arrested. Initially, they tried to spin a bunch of lies about Savannah, saying that she had abandoned her child with them to run away because she was unhappy with her family and her boyfriend. But these were obviously lies and easily proven so. 3 days later, Savannah's remains were found by the kayakers on the Red River. Savannah's murder sparked outrage across the U.S. So this is really sad. Savannah had been found in the Red River, the same river where only years earlier, 15-year-old Tina Fontaine, a Cree girl from Manitoba, was found, her body wrapped in a duvet and weighed down with rocks. So the Red River goes down through Manitoba and into North Dakota. After Tina's body was found in 2014, officials and volunteers from the Indigenous nations on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border dragged the river searching for more missing women. They ended up finding 7 bodies in 1 year, and Savannah added to that number.
Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. That's so sad. Wow.
So the fact that Savannah was one of the many Native women in North Dakota and the U.S. to be murdered is infuriating. Outrage sparked North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp to introduce Savannah's Act in October of 2017. Savannah's Act sought to expand tribal access to federal crime databases and establish law enforcement protocols for handling the cases of Native Americans. The Act would also require data of these cases to have accurate statistics and annual reports to Congress, essentially making sure missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and two-spirited people in the U.S. are not ignored at the federal level. Savannah's Act would also increase access for reservation authorities to the national crime databases, like the FBI's Missing Persons Database. While the bill was stalled for a while, Savannah's Act became public law in October of 2020. Savannah's killers were found guilty and sentenced to jail. Brooke was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for the murder and kidnapping of Savannah and her child. William was sentenced to 20 years in prison for conspiracy to commit kidnapping and lying to the police. Finally, Ashton received full custody of his and Savannah's baby girl. Savannah's daughter remained healthy throughout the entire ordeal and has grown up with her father on the reserve. She's now a healthy and happy 3-year-old. And that is the murder of Savannah LaFontaine Graywind.
Wow. That's so sad. I'm glad that she was healthy, though. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. I've heard, like, quite a few stories now of, like, women being killed for their babies, and it just, I don't know.
It's so horrific every time.
Yeah. It's just unimaginable to me that someone, like, could do that. Wow.
And most often it's other women as well.
Yeah. It's like they can't have a baby of their own, so they think the only way to do it is to kill someone to take their own. Jump over into mine.
Yeah. You're taking us to Quebec, right?
I'm taking us to Quebec. And my case, unfortunately, does not get any justice. So I am doing the disappearance of Maisie Ojek and Shannon Alexander. So my sources this week were CBC and the Stories of the Unsolved.com. Again, not a ton of information. And you'll see why once I jump into the case. Shannon Mary Dale Alexander was born March 29th, 1991. A member of the Kitigan Zibi Anishinaabeg First Nation, she lived in a nearby town of Maniwaki, Quebec, with her father, Brian Alexander. According to those who knew her, Shannon was an outgoing and lovely girl who would go out of her way to help those she cared about. She liked to stay fit, and she was known for her passionate spirit, as she was always looking to pursue goals she held in life. A cadet at her local high school, she had plans to attend nursing school in the fall in Montlaurier, with Brian having already paid for her tuition. Maisie Marie Ojek was born on November 6, 1991. Like Shannon, she was a member of the Kitigan Zibi Anishinaabeg First Nation and lived on the reserve with her mother and grandmother. She was known for being very hands-on, loving to sew her own clothes and draw, and she spent her free time with her friends and family. Maisie and her best friend Shannon, who were both 17 at the time, were reported missing in September 2008. The two girls were best friends. They attended high school together and partook in typical teenager activities, such as gossiping about boys and socializing at popular hangouts. They often held sleepovers at Shannon's house and were overall well-behaved, never getting into trouble nor participating in behavior that would be deemed high risk. So when the two suddenly disappeared, it was a shock to everyone that knew them.
Can I just say, I hate when people say that high a victim's risk. Behavior is high risk.
I know. I kept that in there because I was like, we're definitely going to have to talk about, like, it doesn't matter if your activities are high risk or not. You're still a person who deserves justice.
Yeah, because it's like, inherently victim blaming.
Yeah. Like, it's not...
It's like, walking home alone at night is high risk. Like, I know inherently there is risk, but it's like, you shouldn't call that a high risk behavior.
Yeah. And like, especially if it's like something that you don't have a choice to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So the last time Maisie's mom, Lori, saw her daughter was on Friday, September 5th. Maisie and Shannon were outside Maisie's grandmother's house mowing the lawn. So because Maisie lived with her grandmother, she usually mowed the lawn on Saturday mornings. Lori asked her why she was doing it on a Friday night, and she said that she was going to spend the weekend with Shannon because her dad was going to help his son in Ottawa paint. I'm not sure paint what, but he was going out of town. Shannon lived in Maniwaki, and that town was adjacent to the reserve. Maisie often spent nights at her place, and the girls also told her that they were going to a school dance. They went to the Maniwaki arena for the dance that night. Other friends who were at the dance saw the girls leave the arena. This was the last time anyone saw either of the girls. Although I have a conflicting statement, because apparently the next day Shannon walked her father to the bus station while Maisie slept in. Brian going to Ottawa. And
weird.
Saying that this would be the last time he saw the girls. So
I wonder if it was like the last time they were saw in public and then the last time any of their family saw them.
Yeah. So when Shannon's father returned to his apartment, Lori said he found... the girls had left behind their purses, wallets, ID, and backpacks. Shannon had even left her medication behind. Lori says she believes the investigation into their disappearance was mishandled from the beginning by the Kitigan Zibi police. She said her daughter and her friend were labeled out as runaways. The apartment that Shannon's dad and her had lived at the time wasn't even searched. She said her family never got a file number and the police did not notify the media of the disappearance. She said, I mean, even the chief and council, it seemed like nobody cared at the time.
Yeah. It's so frustrating. Also, like, how old are they? Like,
17.
17? Okay, yeah. It's old enough to, like, go places by themselves and have that autonomy. But if don't call them a runaway. If they left... everything they need to run away at home.
Yeah.
Like...
especially medication that you need to take.
Exactly. IDs, medication, purses, money. It's obviously not a runaway. Even I can say that, and I'm not a police officer.
Maisie's aunt, Marie Jacko, built a website with information about the girls' disappearance. Then more than 6 days after the girls went missing... Kitigan Zibi Chief Gilbert White Duck arranged for a news conference, and only the town paper and the APTN showed up. She and other volunteers started searching on their own without the help of police. After a month went by, the police notified the public, but Lori feels that valuable evidence was lost by then. Which, I mean, makes sense. Like, isn't it 48 hours is the most crucial time for any missing persons case?
Yeah, like the first 24, especially with underage girls.
Eventually, Search and Rescue Global 1 was invited into the community by the chief and council. They conducted two searches, with the first involving the Ottawa Valley Search and Rescue Dog Association and around 100 community members combing a 5-kilometer area around Brian's apartment. The second occurred in May 2009, but both failed to uncover any evidence. That same month, bones were found near the reserve. While they were first believed to be related to the case, tests revealed that they just belonged to animals. Investigators say that they've received tips that the girls have been seen in Montreal, Quebec, Ottawa. As a result, they held a news conference in Ontario City, where they further revealed more sightings. According to tips, it's possible that Shannon and Maisie have been seen in numerous areas around the eastern and southern areas of the province. The Ontario Provincial Police added profiles of both girls to their missing persons webpage. In 2009, the Sûreté du Québec Provincial Police took over the case. Laurie says relations with the lead investigator are now good. From the very beginning, he calls me. Even if he knows nothing, it's just reassurance that she's not forgotten, and that makes a world of a difference. Laurie added that the detective has given her his personal cell phone number, and she realizes that they may never get answers for what happened to the girls. She has also said that the lead police investigator has told her that Maisie's file may soon be shelved. He told me that there is going to become a time when Maisie's file will be a cold case, only meaning that with no information coming in and the investigating they've done leads to nowhere. In August 2011, investigators revealed the pair may have come into contact with a local sex offender. The unnamed man died by suicide in July 2011 whilst being held in the Hull jail, leaving behind a suicide note. Not much else has been shared regarding this aspect of the investigation, so who knows where that went. October 2013 saw two awareness campaigns held. The first was the Sisters in Spirit March at Parliament Hill, which aimed to highlight Canada's numerous cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The second was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police social media campaign, which highlighted 10 cases of missing Indigenous women, including Maisie and Shannon. In December 2015, age progression sketches were released to show what the girls might look like now that they were 24, and new information about the disappearance was received in July 2017, which led to the search of the Pitobeg Creek on the Kitigan-Zibi Reserve. The area was near Paganakoman Road and Maniwaki Speedway. Investigators have been led to believe that Shannon and Maisie's bodies could be found there, so they used a small excavator, a forensic team, an emergency unit, and dive teams to search the waters and surrounding areas. Unfortunately, nothing was found, and police learned that the speedway has been expanded over the years, meaning that the shoreline may have been disturbed by moved dirt. At this time, 20 individuals were interviewed in relation to the case. A billboard has been set up by the entrance of the reserve, which features the pair's names, images, numbers drivers can call if they have any information. And on the 10th anniversary of Maisie and Shannon's disappearance, investigators set up a command post in the Community Cultural Center and urged people to send in new leads. A second billboard, which is digital, was installed along Highway 105, the main road that runs through the reserve, in February 2020. It features information about the case as well as of Cindy Rupert House, who was missing from Val d'Or, Quebec, on April 23, 2014. The project is one of more than 100 being funded by Canada's National Inquiry into the country's missing and murdered Indigenous women. The billboard itself will be used to display unsolved missing persons and homicide cases and will serve as an alert system for the surrounding region, which I think is great. I think, like, that's one thing that's really cool with now having, like, digital billboards is the fact that they can just, like, rotate and keep things updated. Detectives have shared that a majority of tips came in during the first 3 months of the investigation. They have officially ruled out that the girls left voluntarily and are working on the assumption that their disappearances are suspicious and possibly resulted in homicide. Over the course of the investigation, the Sûreté du Québec has collaborated with a host of other police agencies, including the OPP, the RCMP, and the Kitigan-Sibi Police Department. Shannon and Maisie's families hold a march and vigil in Kitigan-Sibi each year in order to maintain awareness around their disappearance. Maisie's extended family also holds an annual walk or run to help raise money for a reward fund. Lori published a poem dedicated to her daughter, and she also has been asked to speak at various events related to missing and murdered Indigenous women, and publicly supports groups that bring awareness to the case, such as the Red Dress Project and Walking with Our Sisters. She is one of many who traveled to Ottawa to speak with federal ministers during Canada's national inquiry. While she hoped the inquiry would look into the relationship between families and law enforcement, she has since questioned the federal government's actions and findings. Maisie's cousin, Jennifer Tenasco, is a runner who is also raising awareness about the case and of those other Indigenous women. She has competed in the Ontario Aboriginal Summer Games. Lori firmly believes that there are people out there that know what happened to her daughter and her best friend. I mean, two girls just don't disappear off the face of the earth, and I'm hoping one day those people who know something will step forward. And that is the case of Maisie and Shannon.
It's really scary that the two of them disappeared together.
Yeah. Clearly there was enough, like, force to be able to take both of them.
Or they went willingly because they knew the person, and then
something bad happened.
Yeah. That's why, like, the first 24 to 48 are so important.
Yeah.
Because everything is fresh in people's minds.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that, like, they went to the police, and, like, the chief and the council of the reserve didn't take it seriously as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought it was, like, the chief of police.
No, the chief and the council were like, No, they just ran away.
Oh.
Like, everyone in the community basically just thought that they had left, and so nothing happened.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah. Very sad. Unfortunately, there's no other information, so, I mean, hopefully they're alive somewhere, and nothing bad has happened to them, but
there's, like, not very much we can add to these conversations.
Yeah. Especially, like, when, like, they're not solved, there's absolutely no information. It's just they disappeared off the face of the earth. It's like, well, what else do you say? Like, it's just sad.
Do we move on to happier things?
Yeah. Not really that much happier, but Trina Hunt, was missing from the Vancouver area, from Port Moody. Her body was found. So that's quite sad. I mean, they found her body over a month ago. So,
oh, really?
Clearly, they found a body. They found the body in, what am I saying? They found her body in March.
Because this was one of the women that you had talked about on the podcast a while ago.
Yeah. Who from our area had gone missing.
Yeah.
So clearly.
I read that the husband was not cooperative with the police at all.
Yeah.
So,
like, he said that they went up to Hope, but he couldn't remember what car they drove. Like, Okay. Like, how hard is that to remember? But I have a feeling that her body was pretty badly destroyed if it took over a month for them to, like, actually publicly state that it was her body.
Well, I don't know what the, like, publishing guidelines are. Like, I don't know. They could have identified her and then sat on the information for a month while they're trying to keep it quiet from the public to do some sort of investigating.
Yeah, that's true. Because they had posted, there was articles back in March saying that a body had been found. Mm-hmm. And that they didn't know who it was. Yeah, so, I mean, it must be nice for her family to have a little bit of closure. surrounding that. But happier things, Harry Styles, My Policeman. There's been so many photos that have been coming out.
I saw some of them, yeah.
Oh, and another thing that came out that has also made me, like, violently ill. I don't know when they were taken because I literally, like, I can't.
What?
There was a video, like, Harry and Olivia were in, like a sandwich shop or something. I don't know when this was taken, and I really hope that it wasn't recently because I literally just cannot handle it. But, like, she was, like, hugging him from behind, and they were, like, walking around the store together, like, it was so cute, and I was like, I can't do this, like, this is, no, like, we're not, I can't, and every time it, like, comes up on, like, my TikTok page or, like, my Explorer, I, like, throw my phone across the room, I'm like, not today, we're not dealing with this.
Keegan's like, this should be me.
Yeah.
I have an Uncle Rick update. Ooh. I did text it to you a while ago, yes. But I need to discuss it on the podcast because I've fallen down with my Uncle Rick updates. If you forget, Uncle Rick is what the Percy Jackson fandom calls the author of the Percy Jackson series, Rick Riordan. But they are now casting for the Percy Jackson Disney Plus TV show. So, you know, Uncle Rick put out on his website, you know, an open call for Percy Jackson.
I swear to God, if they do not cast Logan Learman in this series, I...
As Poseidon.
...will murder someone. And then Megan can cover it on the podcast while I sit in jail.
Oh, no.
Logan Learman, oh my God. He is a beautiful man. Like, I think it's, like, Harry Styles, then Logan Learman in my, like, men I need to marry list.
I think he has a girlfriend.
He does.
I'm sorry.
That's why he's...
Okay, yeah. I was looking him up the other day because I was having this conversation with someone else, and I was trying to look up how old he was, and then it popped up, like, Logan Lerman's wife, and I was like, wait, what? He's married? But no, it was just a girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, quarantine did him good. His hair is long. He's got, like, this little gray, like, piece of hair that's, like, right at the, like, front of it. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny. I was, like, having drinks with my friend Morgan, who lives on the street from me, in, you know, like, spaced out 2 meters apart in their backyard, like, sitting on lawn chairs. But it was, like, me and then Mike, my boyfriend, and then Morgan and her boyfriend Alex, and then like her sister's boyfriend, and then her dad like popped in and out, but all of the men had long hair. Like they all, like my boyfriend Mike has long hair and so did her boyfriend, and then her sister's boyfriend and her dad has like long hair. So it's like the quarantine, you know, the quarantine fashion style has really lengthened men's hair.
Yeah. No, was it, did Mike post something or did you send me a Snapchat? And I was like, oh my God, your guys' hair is almost the same length.
I think I probably sent you a Snapchat. Yeah. I saw this interesting, okay, it was a TikTok, so take this with a grain of salt, but she was quoting like an academic article. But you know, those can be biased, whatever. There's my disclaimer before I talk about this. But I was watching this TikTok and this girl was saying that there's a correlation between men's hair length and women's skirt hem length with the state of the economy. So think like 1920s, the roaring 20s, the economy was doing great. Women's skirts were really short. But then in the Great Depression, everything was really terrible. Women's skirts were really long, like ankle length. So it was like, that's so interesting because I only wear like knee length skirts, like midi skirts.
Yeah.
What does that say about my economic state?
Yeah. All I have in my head right now, and it doesn't even apply, is black dress with the tights, underneath.
Yep. Yep. I also see all these TikToks about like Y2K styles, and then someone was like a teenager in Y2K. She's like, what is in style now for Y2K is not Y2K. this is Y2K. And she's like a brown Abercrombie shirt, no, Aeropostale shirt with like long sleeves underneath. And then like literal jeans, UGG boots, and a skirt over top of the literal jeans.
Yeah.
That's Y2K.
Like boot cut jeans.
Yes.
With a plaid pleated skirt over top.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, it's funny. Apparently, I saw a TikTok that's saying that the 20-year, like, fashion cycle is no longer a thing because there's, like, micro cycles happening in it now where it's, like, they're only cool for, like, a month because of, like, all of the social media and that's...
Everything moves so quickly.
Yeah. Like, I'm just happy with, like, my own style. In therapy last week, I can't remember if I talked about this, but I was talking about like lack of like motivation to like just do anything. And because I've been at home, like I never have been someone who, like, I'm not someone who has like clothes to like wear at home. Like I have like, like fun, like really cool, like clothes for outside, and then like I have my pajamas and that's it. Yeah. And so my case manager was like, why don't you just get clothes for like home that are like cute? So it's funny that we've been in quarantine for over a year and I'm like, okay, now it's time to buy some clothes for home. So I got a couple like really cute sets of just like comfy clothes to wear at home, so that when I am working from home, I like still can like dress up.
Cute.
Yeah. And like, she was like, you still have to, like, why don't you deserve to look good for yourself? Like, you get ready and look good for the world, but like, you also deserve that for you too. So he's like, damn, homie, that hits hard.
It's funny that you say that because this weekend I literally bought like a cute comfy set to wear at home.
Yeah.
And I'm wearing it right now. It's from Aerie, American Eagle.
I love their stuff that's coming out right now.
I know, same. But it's like this cute little sweatsuit top thing. And then these like high-waisted
shorts. Oh, they're so cute. I kind of got something like that too.
Shorts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I bought, like, a cute PJ set as well, so.
Yay.
But it's true, I'm almost like, why would I spend money on something I can wear at home when I have, like, all these old raggedy t-shirts around? But now it's like, we're literally always home, so if I just only wear those raggedy t-shirts and, like, ugly sweatpants.
Yeah, you just don't, it's, like, getting ready is part of your day that is important. Just because you're not seeing anyone doesn't mean that you can't look after yourself.
Yeah, I typically wake up like 10 minutes before I have to work, and then I roll out of bed. I like grab a coffee, start to work, and about 10:30, I'm like, I guess I should probably like wash my face and brush my teeth and like.
I do the same thing too. The other thing that happened to me in therapy, I already talked about this with Megan, but it has just been making me laugh all week. So, here's some content for you guys, I guess. I was really struggling with like thinking that like I don't have an eating disorder, and I was telling my therapist about it. I was like, no, like it's fine. I'm just not eating properly. I just have disordered eating. I don't have an eating disorder. And she like looked at me and she was like, Tegan, like 4 different people have diagnosed you with an eating disorder. I have diagnosed you with an eating disorder. Why are you letting some person on the internet who is creating a recovery page, like, tell you that you don't? And apparently my face dropped after that. And she, after our session, she called me and she was like, I'm so sorry if I hurt your feelings by saying that. Like, I know I was being sassy, but, like, I'm just really sorry. It's like, no, you didn't hurt my feelings. Like, you just, like, made me, like, be like, oh, yeah, like,
maybe I should listen to my 4 different doctors.
Like, whoops, that makes sense. I was like, no, if anything, like, you just made my eating disorder angry. That's why my face dropped off. I'm like, you don't have to apologize. Like, I laughed. You're being sassy. I like it. Like,
that's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny, but it's sad.
Yeah, I know. It was like, doy.
You're like, obviously. Oh, yeah. Also, she's your, like, therapist in your eating disorder program, yeah. Isn't she?
Yeah. She's so, like, you're here for a reason.
Yeah. Also, like, you've been telling me how difficult it's been to get into this program.
Yeah.
So, like, if you didn't have one, Tegan, you wouldn't be in there.
Yeah.
Which is, like, sorry, I don't want to, I know I'm kind of being sassy as well, but we've talked about this a lot.
Yeah, it's, like, if there's only 40 people in this program, then, like, maybe. What? Whoa. I live by the train tracks, and I am currently watching a car drive on the train tracks. And then there's another car with an excavator. Like, it's like those cars for the train tracks.
Oh, I thought it was just like some car
driving on the train tracks. No, it's over the train, the bridge for the train.
Oh, interesting.
I've never seen that. There's like a little excavator and it looks like a semi just like driving across the train tracks. That's funny.
Where was I? I was somewhere at some point. But like when they're doing... What?
I was somewhere at some point.
But I was. But it was, like, along the train tracks, and these guys were, like, you know, fixing up the tracks or whatever. And I love the, like, little, like, truck things that they drive on the tracks. Like, yeah. It looks like a mixture between a truck and an excavator, and it's, like, a little bit, like, industrial, but then you also can tell it's, like, just a car, like, or just a truck.
Yeah.
And they were funny. I don't know why. I was like, look at them.
I love the smell of train tracks.
Oh, you like the creosote or whatever it's called?
I don't know. There's just like something about it where I'm just like...
It smells like burning rubber mixed with wood.
Maybe it just reminds me of the outdoors.
Maybe. Are you one of those people who likes the smell of gasoline?
Yeah.
Ugh. Gross.
I loved it a lot more when I was little.
It's always given me a headache.
It doesn't give me a headache. I remember when I was little, like, wanting to be outside the car when my parents were pumping gas because I was like,
delicious. It's
so weird. But now I pump my own gas and, like, I don't know, maybe I've just become more accustomed to the smell, but like, I don't smell it anymore. I remember when we did the DARE program in school and they were talking about, like, different types of drugs, and they were like, yeah, people like huff paint and stuff and gasoline, and I was like, oh my god, I'm a drug addict because I like the smell of gas.
I never got like a drug chalk.
We did
in school.
We did the DARE program and we got cake and...
Was it DARE? I thought that was just in the US.
No, it was the DARE program because I remember we got pencils. But I think that it's funny that like our school did it.
When you were in, like, grade 7?
Yeah.
Like, elementary school.
Yeah.
Elementary school.
When I went to high school, like, literally 6 months after I completed that program, I, like, wanted to cry because I saw people smoking. There was a girl in my PE class who used to smoke while we would walk to...
Smoke cigarettes?
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my god, what is going on? This 13-year-old girl is telling me that her and her mom are trying to quit smoking together. I'm just like, what?
It's funny because everyone was like, so many people were like, oh my god, weed is going to be legal in Canada. Like, now everyone's going to do it. And it's like, nope.
Yeah.
It's nope.
No.
It's just regulated. I have never felt the need.
Yeah. I don't know why, like, I'm just, like, stuck on this whole drug thing. Maybe, like, my dad did kind of scare me a little bit with it. Because, like, grade 8, when I went to that school dance, my dad was like, Tegan, drugs. You don't know if people are gonna sneak them in. He's like, do you know the size of acid? He's like, this is back when flip phones were a thing. He's like, you can put a tab of acid into, like, onto the keyboard of your phone and sneak that kind of stuff in. It's so easy. And now I'm thinking back on it, I'm like, Dad, how did you know that?
He'd probably watch some, like, CBC Marketplace, like, exposed thing. It's like, kids were sneaking tabs of acid into their school dances via their cell phone keyboards. Oh no.
I don't know. Brian was very paranoid about the fact that I was going to get murdered and kidnapped.
Should we pull our countries for, or pull our spots for next week?
I just want to talk about a TV show that I watched called The Purge, and I would highly recommend it.
Is it like the movies?
Yes. Okay. I don't know because I've never watched the movies, and like I was kind of like iffy about watching it, but my roommate was like, "Do you want to?" And I was like, "Fine." But it follows like the stories of like seven people through their purge night, and they're all people like that aren't committing crimes. Oh. And it's like them like living their lives through,
just like trying to survive.
Yeah,
that's kind of interesting.
So it's kind of cool, and it has flashbacks to like before like the purge, like mm-hmm. in their life. So it's like them living their lives, and then, you know, like key parts of their lives kind of come to light through the night. So it was pretty interesting. It was 10 episodes, I think. So if you're looking for a drama to watch,
where do you watch?
Amazon Prime.
Okay. Yeah, I was like, that doesn't sound like a Netflix thing. It sounds like an Amazon Prime thing.
Yeah. So that was pretty good.
Okay, well, should we
pull our countries on that note?
Shall we pull our countries then?
I guess we shall.
Do you want to know where you're going next week, Tegan?
Yes, please.
For the final week of our missing and murdered Indigenous women cases, you are going to Australia.
Ooh. Back in Oz. I don't know why I said that.
Back in Oz.
This will be good, because I don't think I've like ever really looked at any missing and cases for Indigenous women in Australia.
And next week I am going to New Zealand.
Ooh, that's fun that we're both in the Southern Hemisphere.
Well, I can hear my laptop overheating, so it's time to go.
I can hear it too.
Thank you for listening, everyone. Tune in next week. We are going to New Zealand and Australia to cover missing and murdered Indigenous women there. And goodbye, but as you say it in Lakota, Doksha Ake.
Au revoir.
Be in your ear holes next week. Ciao.
Arrivederci.